Good day and welcome to Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. For 5 years after the adoption of the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution abolishing slavery in 1865, women, mostly from China, were bought and sold with the assistance of the city of San Francisco out in the open at a San Francisco harbor. Eventually, the slave trade would go underground, but would last for another 70 years up until the 1930s. Today, we'll be in conversation about this history and the abolitionist movement against it that was led by women. My guest is author and journalist Julia Flynn Seiler. She is the author of a book on this history. It's called The White Devil's Daughters, The Women Who Fought Slavery in San Francisco's Chinatown. Julia Flynn Seiler, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to our radio station.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here, Mitch. Thank you.
I found the story that you told and the circumstances around it to be quite incredible. And one of the things that stood out to me immediately was slavery was abolished in 1865 with the adoption of the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution. But between 1865 and right around 1870, you'll correct me if I'm off on that, young Chinese women were being sold out in the open here in San Francisco.
Yes, there were numerous accounts of this. The steamers from China would pull into San Francisco's port, and sometimes hundreds of young women and girls, really we should refer to many of them as girls, because they ranged in age anywhere from 6 years old to 14 or 15 years old, would disembark, and they would be sold off. And it was a shocking phenomenon. And eventually the newspapers wrote about this in outraged tones, and those auctions simply moved. They moved to a place called the Queen's Room, which was an ironic name, and it referred to essentially a barracoon or a kind of corral for human beings. And the girls would be inspected and sold. And we don't know how long exactly that lasted, certainly in the second half of the 19th century. But the phenomenon of sex slavery continued through the 19th century and into the 20th
century. Into the 20th century. You write about experiences that are well into the 1930s, the Great Depression era.
Well, the very first scene in the book is one in which a teenage girl in 1933 runs from her traffickers to a safe house. And I follow this. The structure of the book is built around a very famous legal case, which broke up a very prominent human trafficking ring that was operating out of San Francisco's Chinatown in the 1930s, but probably had brought dozens, perhaps even many, many more women over a period of decades into the West Coast.
And this one young woman that you wrote about in the 1930s who escaped, her name was Zheng Guiying.
Yes.
How do you find information about her? How did you do research on this?
Yes. The case was very, very well known at the time. Yeah. It was splashed all over the newspapers. It even made it into the kind of glossy true crime magazines of the era. That said, our National Archives in San Bruno has had very, very extensive records, not only the court records, but also immigration records related to them, and many photographs, which as a researcher and a writer are so powerful as a way to bring a story to life. So there had also been other scholars who had tracked and followed what was known as the Broken Blossoms case, including Eddie Wong, who had written about it in an article that was published by the National Archives.
And we'll get into the Broken Blossom case, as you indicated, a very important case. I want to go back to 1865, 1870, and again, just really underline, before it goes underground, how it was, I mean, the police were there. I mean, the city of San Francisco was complicit.
Absolutely. And that was one of the most startling things I learned in researching this period of time, and that the immigration officers, all of whom were white, and the police officers often escorted wagon fulls of women up to Chinatown, to the brothels.
They escorted the
women. They escorted them. Yeah. And there were bribes paid, and they were very much part of this. They were profiting from this trade in human beings.
When the newspapers were writing about this, were they like, hey, what happened? You know, we just had the ratification of the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery. Well, was it seen as slavery at the time?
It was. During that period of time, they weren't using words like human trafficking, the words we would use now, but they would use words like slave girls. This is an outrageous trade in slave girls, Chinese slave girls. And certainly there were some journalists and also some activists who called this slavery, modern day slavery, and said, essentially, we think there needs to be an abolitionist cry. We need an abolition movement to address this social injustice involving the trafficking of Asian women in the 19th century.
And you would get it. Set the scene for me. Tell me about San Francisco mid-19th century. San Francisco, I believe, has the oldest Chinatown in North America.
It does. In the 19th century, San Francisco's Chinatown was the capital of Chinese America. It was roughly an 8-square-block area, and it encompassed the original part of the city, which, of course, was Portsmouth Square. It was also the most densely populated part of the city. In that 8 blocks, there were approximately 12,000 people living. And the most startling thing about it was that almost all of those people, 9 out of 10 of them, were men. There were very, very few women in Chinatown during that time, in part because of the laws such as the Page Act, which was designed to keep Chinese women from coming to the United States, but also because many Chinese men left their wives and families at home in China to work in the United States with the goal of returning to China eventually.
So it, as you were saying, over 90% of Chinese in San Francisco are men, so not very many women. And there's also another element here that you write about are the anti-miscegenation laws in San Francisco that disallowed Chinese men from marrying any other woman other than Chinese women.
Yes. These were laws that prohibited Chinese men from marrying white women. And vice versa.
And so are the Chinese men then, it sounds like they're implicit in this slavery as well. Are they the ones buying the women or girls?
The answer is that the brothels were frequented by both white men and Chinese men. The overall population of San Francisco was also, there was a gender imbalance. There were more men than women. Yeah. And that was kind of left over from the gold rush. And it was kind of a wild, wild place in that period of time. One newspaper described it as the cussedest place for women. It was not a friendly place. So the men who were demand, there was a very large pent-up demand for sex, both from white men and Chinese men. And the brothel owners themselves tended to be both white and Chinese. Okay. But in Chinatown, they were mostly Chinese.
Okay. And so it's the brothels who are purchasing them, and
yes,
they would buy them. And there's a whole business set up around this.
Yes.
What do we know about the women who are coming from China who were sold into slavery?
They tend to be very young. Often their families would contract with someone who had promised their daughters a good job of some sort, a restaurant job or sewing or something like that. They would give the parents money, they would ship them off on a steamer, they'd get to San Francisco, and they immediately realized they were headed towards the brothels. So they'd been tricked into prostitution. And of course, the way we look at this now is that when you are 13 years old and you're headed towards the brothel, what's then happens is rape and sexual abuse.
It sounds familiar, just as though this is a story of today of women who are trafficked. They're there, promised good jobs somewhere else, and they get there, and lo and behold, they're basically enslaved as well.
Yes, and similarly, documents are taken away from them. Oftentimes, women who are trafficked, were trafficked then and now, don't have the language to be able to get themselves easily out of the situation in which they're trafficked.
again, as you say, Chinese girls sold into slavery here in San Francisco. I can't help but think of the voyage over the Pacific Ocean. It reminds me somewhat of the middle. I mean, it makes me think of the Middle Passage in the transatlantic slave trade.
Well, my sense is that, and I'm not an expert in this, but I have read about the Middle Passage, and I do have some accounts of the young women who came across on steamers. The conditions in the Middle Passage were so horrifying, and in those cases, you had 500, 700 human beings crammed into the lower holds of these boats. In trafficking situations, it may have been a few hundred, or it may have been a few dozen for the women involved. So it was not on the same level as the transatlantic slave trade in Africans.
Did you know the conditions that they faced being on the ships coming over? Were you able to find that? Because it's pretty remarkable the amount of material, archival, mm-hmm. and even firsthand accounts you were able to find.
Yes. Probably the best account I have is from a young woman. It's a startling account of her memories of being on the steamer. She was very young at the time, 8 or 9. And her main memory, and I remember this is, she's being asked the question about that steamship ride 50 years later, but was of banging on the doors of a cabin. So she would have been a more upper class girl who's being trafficked and it being locked from the outside and not understanding what was happening to her because she was a very, very young girl.
How much of this story was already known and how much did you find from, I guess, first sources,
mm-hmm.
Primary sources?
One of the main characters in my book was a woman named Donaldina Cameron. And there have been two biographies written of Donaldina Cameron that were published, one in the 1930s, one in the 70s. There was a third one published a few years ago privately, which was partly fictionalized, so I didn't really look at that one very carefully. So there had been some interesting work done around Donaldina Cameron. Meanwhile, there had been some scholarly work done about the home, mainly by the scholar Peggy Pasco, who has sadly since passed away. But she's the scholar who got closest to trying to understand what the lives of the residents of the home was like, and what the dynamics between the staff and the residents of the home. To answer your question more directly, a lot of this book is original because one of the things the biographers from 40 and 80 years ago did not do was they did not go into court records. They did not go to the National Archives. They didn't have the opportunity to go to the Library of Congress. I did a lot of work with primary documents to try to recreate the stories of these women's lives the residents' lives who had mostly been lost,
yeah,
or people didn't know about.
So you really got into the immigration records and,
yes,
and everything else like that.
Yes.
Was that difficult to do? I mean, I'm sure it was time consuming. How hard was it to get to that information?
It was time consuming. I mean, to go to the National Archives in San Bruno took an appointment that would usually take a few weeks. And I probably paid half a dozen, maybe even a dozen visits there. Likewise, I got immigration records from the Seattle office and did that by mail. And that would take a few months to do. And I worked in the Presbyterian Historical Society's archives as well, and visited those archives a few times and also worked by mail. So all of this took quite a long time, and but I think was worth it.
You're putting your investigative journalist skills,
yes,
to work, which you have a past in. You wrote for the Wall Street Journal. And
yes, I was a staff writer for the Wall Street Journal and have written for other publications. So my background is as a journalist, and I feel very comfortable in archives. I love research and digging and looking for stuff. Yeah.
This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation with Julia Flynn Seiler, author and journalist. Her latest book is called The White Devil's Daughters, The Woman Who Fought Slavery in San Francisco's Chinatown. I don't usually ask a question about the title of a book, but actually this title is significant. The White Devil's Daughter. What does that mean?
Well, the White Devil is a translation of a Chinese expression, a very common Chinese translation, which can be translated as White Devil or in other ways as well. And it was a derogatory term used to describe Donaldina Cameron by her enemies. And she was, the way I see it, is she was so effective with her, really with her team of both Chinese women and a larger circle of volunteer lawyers and other folks, policemen who were helping her, that she disrupted their business. And so they started calling her names. And that name became well known for her. And referring to her daughter, she, within the home, some of the young women, many of the young women, took to calling her by a nickname, which is Lo Mo, and that means old mother. And one of the most moving parts of my research was going down to the archives or special collections at Stanford and finding Mother's Day cards written to Donaldina from the former residents from all over the country. And it was extremely touching.
I think I better ask you about this home so people know that we're not talking about the brothel anymore.
Oh, sure, sure.
This is a home on Sacramento Street.
Yes, 920 Sacramento Street. The building is still there today. And this was a charitable project set up in the 1870s by a group of church women. And they saw the plight of girls, Chinese girls and women in Chinatown, and they decided they wanted to try to do something about this. And it initially, they scraped up enough money to rent an apartment. And then the apartment got too crowded, and they ended up buying a building roughly right across the street, 920 Sacramento Street, kind of in the shadow of Nob Hill. And that building opened in the 1870s and had, you know, many, many, many women went through. My best estimate is between 2,000 and 3,000 girls.
Two to 3,000 girls.
Yes.
Who were kidnapped, enslaved, escaped there.
Yes. Well, women and girls came in different circumstances, but certainly in the early days, there was a higher proportion of young women who were escaping sex slavery and taking refuge there. In the later days, it became almost like an early version of a safe home for women who were vulnerable in one way or the other.
What is it today?
It's a key social services agency in San Francisco's Chinatown. It provides a food pantry once a week to members of the community. It offers English as a second language classes and has a lot of child care and after school programs. I mean, every reading I do for this book, someone comes up to me and says, I was a Cameron House kid. And what they mean is that they participated in kids programs.
That's what it's called today, Cameron House.
It's now called Cameron House in honor of Donaldina Cameron.
So they are holding on to that tradition.
Yes.
I want to get more into the bio of these women. And Donaldina Cameron actually had a predecessor.
Yes, she did.
In all this, Margaret Culbertson.
Yes.
Who is Margaret Culbertson?
Margaret Culbertson was a woman from New York, upstate New York, and a single lady, a church lady. She was a Presbyterian, and she took a job. She also was a child of missionaries. So she had familiarity with Chinese culture. I think she was born in China. And she took the job as superintendent after a very rough start at the home where the women, the volunteers basically who were brought in to try to run it really had a rough time and didn't do a very good job and didn't have a lot of cultural sensitivity towards the Chinese women
and
girls.
It's already a refuge, though.
Yes, it's already a refuge
for women. Yeah.
Yes. So Margaret Culbertson arrives, and she's very organized. She's a very good and very gentle person, and the young women and the girls really respond to her. And all of a sudden, the house, which had been quite chaotic, It comes into its own and starts to run a lot more smoothly and is much more organized. And she is the person who ran it for more than two decades, and she was also the woman who hired Donaldina Cameron in 1895 as a sewing teacher.
Tell me more about Margaret Culbertson. These are Presbyterians. It's connected to the Presbyterian Church. Is it akin, do you think, if we were to look at, say, abolitionists before the Civil War? I mean, John Brown obviously used violence. It doesn't seem like that's happening here. But I don't know, William Lloyd Garrison. I mean, do you see similarities? Is it akin to what they're doing here? Are they looking at abolitionists as a model?
The larger context I would start with was what historians call the Second Great Awakening. And this was a Protestant movement in the United States and Britain and elsewhere, in which people felt like it was part of their faith to try to make social improvements, to do good in some ways. And of course, during that period of time in the 19th century, American women and British women didn't have the right to vote. They had almost no political or economic power. But in that worldview, in that Victorian worldview, it was okay for them to run a home as a charitable project. Now, they framed this increasingly as they did this work, not just being a charitable project, but as one that fought social ill. And that social ill, the way they saw it, was slavery. And in that sense, they were abolitionists, and they started to use some of the language of abolitionists. I'm reluctant in some ways to compare what they did to somebody like John Brown, because the experiences were very, very different. This is a very small project in some ways, and it is faith-based for sure. But what's so remarkable about it, to me at least, was that this group of people was acting in absolute opposition to the dominant culture, which was a culture that had deep racism towards the Chinese in California. And there was an immense, not only violence towards the Chinese, but there were institutional laws, constrictions, all kinds of things that resulted in deep prejudice against the Chinese. And so they were acting in a way that was defying their husbands, defying their fathers.
This is women led.
Yes, and they called in their very first annual report, these women called their project Woman's Work for Women. So again, they wouldn't use the word feminist, but it was a feminist project too.
Interesting. And what they're doing is they're trying to save girls, women, who have been enslaved, Chinese girls.
Yes, offer them a refuge. And I should say they also hoped to convert them to the Christian faith.
To Christianity. Yeah, I was going to get to that.
Yep. And that was part of it. But the motives of the different women, you have to look at them individually. I mean, one of the most interesting parts of my research was reading the annual report starting in 1874 and going through the 1930s. And they're quite dense. And they talk about how many people converted to the Christian faith who came through the home. And often it was, you know, two or three per year. So their success rate in that sense was not great. On another level, they were hoping to create Christian families. And so the home operated kind of as a marriage bureau. Yeah. Remember that gender discrepancy. There weren't that many Chinese women in America to choose from for Chinese men. And so they knew that there were women at this home. And the women of the home tried to vet the Chinese men to make sure that they weren't traffickers, they weren't criminal Tong members.
Was staying at the home predicated on accepting Jesus Christ?
No, it was not. However, the women who stayed there had to agree to certain basic rules. They had to do chores around the home. They had to go to bed and get up at the, 7 a.m. I mean, there was pretty regimented lifestyle. They were expected to go to chapel, but the measure of conversion, of accepting Jesus, was not something they were forced into doing.
Yeah. So it's not called a Cameron House during this period of time that you write about, in which it's doing this. It was actually called the Occidental Mission Home for Girls.
Yes.
Yeah. Not only did
It had many different names, actually, over time.
Over time?
And like many volunteer organizations, yeah. You know, things kept on changing depending on who was around. Yeah.
And women would escape to this house, and girls, but they also went and found girls and women and rescued them.
Yes, they actively went out. So, for example, here might be a typical rescue scenario. So the supervisor, whether it was superintendent, whether it was Margaret Culbertson or Donaldina Cameron, might get a message from someone saying that there was a young woman or a girl in distress. And so they would take a translator, one of the Chinese aides who worked beside them in the home, usually a resident who had moved up into that position. And they'd also often take along either a detective, a private detective, or a police officer with them. Sometimes they did really kind of wild things. They would climb up and through skylights and, you know, through alleyways and use ladders and stuff like that. Other times the young women and girls would come to the house themselves and would ask for refuge there.
Tell me about Tian Fu Wu.
Yes.
Who was she?
She is one of the key characters in the book, and her story is so remarkable. There are very few really rich accounts of women who have been trafficked, and I would say that Tian's story is very exceptional for that reason, because we have, I was able to not only find audio recordings.
Really?
Of her. I mean, she lived until the 1970s.
Okay. Yeah.
Which is amazing,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
But many, many different accounts of her in her own words describing what had happened to her. So let me tell her story. In the early 1890s, her family, which had been a relatively wealthy family in China, and we know that because Tian's feet had been bound, which is a sign of an upper class crust or a middle, at least upper middle class young girl. But her father ran into gambling debts and was forced to sell her. And so he sold her to a procuress, essentially. Before she left China, she lived in a house with a woman who soaked off the bandages from her feet. And she was young enough that they did eventually expand again. And then she went on to that steamer, and her father accompanied her onto the steamer, locked the door behind her in their cabin, arranged the deal, and little teen, probably 8 or 9 at the time, was banging on the door, wondering what's happening. And anyway, so she arrives in San Francisco, and she ends up...
When does she arrive?
Yes, we think the best guess is she arrives in 1893, 1892 or 1893. And she has been sold as a moitsui, and I'm probably mispronouncing this. It's a term that refers to a child servant, like a little brother, a little sister. And in some cases, this was a very common Chinese practice. And in some cases, the arrangements were very benign. The girl would go live in the home of a wealthier or more established family and do household tasks and be treated kind of kindly as a member of family. In Tian's case and in other cases, that did not happen. Tian ended up in a brothel in Chinatown, and her owners badly abused her and burnt her with hot tongs. And her plight came to the attention of the authorities, who then reached out to the women at the mission home and said, you know, we've heard about this girl being abused. Shall we go get her? And the teen has very searing accounts of being carried by a burly policeman to the home. And she got there, and she quickly made friends with the other girls and eventually kind of settled into the life and the routine at the home. And some of her descriptions of playing at the home and what it was like are just extraordinary, because they're first person.
She wrote it all down?
She wrote it down.
Did she publish a book?
No, she never published a book. There were some oral historians who published a book a few years ago and used her account using a pseudonym. And I was able to confirm that it actually was Tien who they talked to. I think their records are at UC Berkeley, and I found them there.
A pseudonym. So some people are sensitive about this and their connection to it, even if they were a victim of this dynamic.
Yes, absolutely. So they used a pseudonym for her, but we know that this was her. We also know there were other historians of Chinatown who recognized the value of her life story, such as him, Mark Lai, and he did what I think may be the very last recording with Tien before she died. And that's also over at Berkeley, and it was very moving to hear her speak about her life.
Tien Fu Wu would stay at the house.
Yes.
Work at the house.
Yes.
Be an important member of the house and of the movement.
Yes. She was one of the few of the young women who were lucky enough to find sponsors. And so with the help of her, the financial support of her sponsor, she was sent to an elite school in Philadelphia, where she got a very good education and even went to college, a kind of private boarding school and then a college. And she wanted to try to find her family in China, particularly her grandmother and her mother, who she felt so fondly towards. But during that period of time, when she had left China, there were civil wars, there was famine, there was incredible upheaval. So she went back to China and couldn't find a single member of her family. And she realized that the closest thing she had to family were the other girls and women at 920 Sacramento Street. So she came back.
And then what would she do at the house?
She became a staffer.
How long did she stay there?
Oh, my goodness. So she first arrived in 1894. And aside from the period of time when she was east for college, she worked there until the 40s, 1940s. So that was more than almost half a century.
Yeah.
She worked there.
What did she do after that? Did she?
After she retired from the home?
After the 40s, yeah.
Well, that's a great question, because she worked side by side for many years with Donaldina Cameron. And Donaldina really could not have done her job without the help of Tien or the other Chinese staffers at the home, because Donaldina Cameron didn't speak Chinese, and she needed her to be there and to help her. So when Donaldina retired in the mid-30s, she ended up eventually going to Palo Alto, where she had family, and retiring there. And but before that happened, Donaldina had put forward Tien as her replacement and suggested she would be an excellent superintendent. Tien said, no, an American person should take this job. So she declined that offer. And she, in fact, decided she'd much rather go and live with Dolly. And Dolly had a little cottage next to her home. And so for the next 30 years or something, they lived side by side, and they were each other's closest friends and confidants. Tien was there when Dolly died in the late 60s.
And Dolly is Donaldina.
Yes,
just
sorry.
To be clear.
Yes.
Did they continue at all as activists, as reformers?
They that's a wonderful question. Donaldina particularly had become the face of what we would call the anti-trafficking movement, the early anti-trafficking movement. And so throughout that period of time when she was in retirement, she got many, many letters, and occasionally newspaper articles would still be written about her. But she was, other than that, pretty quiet. And Tien, I would have to say that once she retired, no. She took care of Donaldina, and that's how she lived the rest of her life.
Julia Flynn Seiler is our guest. She is an author and a journalist. We're in conversation about her book, The White Devil's Daughters, The Women Who Fought Slavery in San Francisco's Chinatown. Maybe in our time left, we could dive into how this would actually come to an end in San Francisco. But before we get right there in the legal case of the 1930s, what was this big business in San Francisco? Are we talking about the mafia? Are we talking about powerful forces? Were people like Donaldina and Tien Fu Wu in danger?
Well, the answer to both those questions were crime crime syndicates involved? Yes, absolutely. Organized crime. It was big business. It was very lucrative. And this home was disrupting that business. And the result was that absolutely they were in danger. There were sticks of dynamite placed around the home. There were threats, not only legal, but physical threats. They were spat at. They were insulted a great deal. And, you know, it's no coincidence that there were bars on the outside of the windows of the home. And the reason for that was that they were concerned that traffickers would try to break the windows to get in. And there was always somebody guarding the front door. So they were under constant threat. And I should say it was very wearing on the staffers of the home. Yeah. Imagine
did people come back to try. Did people go there to say the mob boss, the mobsters, whoever it may be, go there to try to recapture the women that
absolutely
were staying there?
Yeah. Yes, they would go back to try to recapture women. They often hired very expensive lawyers to accompany them, and they would be, you know, they would.
So they tried to do it through the courts.
Yes,
too,
they tried to do it through the courts, and it was a grind. Yeah. I mean, this safe house was run on, you know, almost no money, and they were constantly in court. And so the women in the home had problems dealing with this. Donaldina herself suffered at least one breakdown, probably more. There were epidemiological threats. The home was right on the edge of Chinatown, so when bubonic plague hit the quarter, everyone was a threat at that point. And likewise, the flu pandemic of 1917, it swept through the home just in the way that it swept through the country and the world. And that was very frightening.
Yeah. It's quite gripping, the story you tell about how they handle the destruction of the 1906 earthquake.
Yes, that was really what inspired me to try to write this book. I read Dolly Cameron's first-person account of the morning of the earthquake and leading those 50 or 60 girls and young women across the burning city. And I mean,
she's leading them across the city.
Yes.
Because what happened to the building?
Well, the building seemed to be okay, but they could see smoke, billows of smoke rising towards the Embarcadero, and they knew they were in danger and they had to move west.
Yeah.
So the first night they walked about a mile to a church on Van Ness Avenue or in that area where they spent the night. And then they realized, you know, at that point, firestorms are breaking out.
Firestorms.
So, firestorms. Yeah. It's the part of the disaster that was really terrible. It's not just the earthquake, but fires everywhere in the city. And it quickly became apparent that Chinatown was going to be completely destroyed, which it was. So from Van Ness, she led this group of women and girls all the way down to the ferry building and managed in that chaos to get them all on that ferry and over to Marin County, where they spent the next few months initially living in a barn. But it was her account was so vivid, and it was so, it was just very stirring and funny, too.
And they all stuck together for months.
They all stuck together. Yeah. Nobody died. Even though the place they had lived essentially was destroyed.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that these mobsters, the people that wanted the women back who found refuge in the house, would even use the courts. Were they ever successful?
Yes, they were successful. You know, they would sometimes win these cases. And
I bought this person.
Yeah.
What?
No, they would say often use ruses like this. Yeah. This girl stole my jewelry. I want the jewelry back and I want her back, too. Or I married her. She's my wife. Give her back. And, you know, I mean, there were a number of different ways which they tried to get them back. Well, I detail one of the most astonishing cases, which took place in 1900. It involved a girl who was kidnapped, trafficked, and then kidnapped. And Donaldina Cameron refused to leave her without her. So they ended up taking a train down to Palo Alto, and there were corrupt justices and constables involved, and there was a court case, and there were protests. And It was quite an astonishing case, but it really shows the way that a number of white officials were involved in supporting trafficking.
Were these young women and girls, did they ever face deportation?
Yes, they did. In fact, sometimes the home was a place where they would stay before they were deported. So, absolutely.
And did people like Donaldina Cameron try to stop them being deported if they didn't want to? I mean,
sometimes she would try that.
Yeah.
And sometimes she would succeed and sometimes not.
Yeah. Okay, let's get into what happens in the 1930s. What is this that brings this whole ring down?
The courage of a few of the very young women who agreed to testify against the head of the trafficking ring. He was a man named Wong Si Duck. He ran supposedly a hardware store on Grant Avenue in the 1930s, but in fact it was a front for a criminal organization. And one of the things that they did was traffic women. And once the prosecuting attorney for the city realized that he had these women who might step forward and testify in open court against them, he realized he had a case. The first time around, the woman we mentioned at the very beginning of our talk was very intimidated by the lawyers, and it resulted in a mistrial. Then they found another woman who was much bolder, and the jury convicted Wong Si Duck and convicted his wife and some of the members of the criminal syndicate, and they were deported.
And what happens? Are there any precedents that are set with this case?
Well, at the time, the newspapers were saying this is the end of the biggest slave ring on the West Coast. Certainly the prosecutors positioned it that way, and the newspapers picked that up. We know, of course, that trafficking continued and continues to this day. So that was wishful thinking.
Yeah. And then there's another person I wanted to ask you about. And you mentioned how Tian Fu Wu went to school.
Mm-hmm.
So did Bessie Jiang.
Yes. Yes.
Tell me about Bessie Jiang.
She's a marvelous character. She ended up running away to the home on her own volition as a teenager, because her father was about to take her back to China, and she presumed he was going to marry her off to someone, and she didn't want to marry. She wanted to go to school. So she took refuge in the home, and she got a lot of support from the staffers there who helped pay for tutors and helped make sure that she not only got accepted and thrived at Stanford, but then was able to continue on and go to medical school. And Bessie Jiang became the first Chinese-American woman to graduate from Stanford University in 1927. It's really fun to find her yearbook photo from that year. And then ultimately, after getting her medical degree, she came back to Chinatown and came back to the Bay Area and helped out with the care, the medical care of the girls and women.
Was there also a writer who
yes.
came out
yes, there was
of
a,
this home?
Yes, not all of the women who came through the mission home were Chinese. There was an extraordinary woman named Yamada Waka. She was a Japanese woman who had been tricked into prostitution, forced prostitution in Seattle. She ended up down in San Francisco, and again, she found her way to the home. She fled to it for safety. And at the time she arrived at the home, she was probably not able to read or write English, but she was a very fast learner. And the home arranged for an outside tutor for her because they realized she was very, very intelligent. She ended up marrying that tutor. It was a Japanese man. And right before the earthquake, they went back to Japan. And this woman, Yamada Waka, not only became a leading feminist writer in Japan, but opened a house that was modeled on 920 Sacramento Street in Japan for vulnerable women and girls. She was so prominent by the 1930s that Eleanor Roosevelt invited her to come visit the White House. And I found an extraordinary photograph of Yamada Waka standing in a traditional kimono in front of the White House after her visit with Roosevelt.
Yamada Waka.
Yamada Waka.
Is she well remembered in Japan? Do you know?
There is a scholar that wrote a very good biography of her, and I reached out to another scholar as well to try to make sure that my characterizations of her were correct.
Okay, can you find those books in English? Or?
Barely. There's one book that I found that's in English, and I did my own digging as well and found some records, some court records of her and some or immigration records and also newspaper accounts of her time in San Francisco.
But you can read about her in English in your book.
Yes, you can.
Yeah, Yamada Waka.
Yes.
Very good. Julia Flynn Seiler, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Again, Julia Flynn Seiler has been our guest. The name of the book, The White Devil's Daughters, The Women Who Fought Slavery in San Francisco's Chinatown.